Ari Rosenbaum with another fun-filled episode of the 401k podcast. And of course, the situation, as with all our episodes, all my episodes, is talking about, you know, future events. Go to that 401ksite.com for information on how to sign up for that 401k National Virtual Conference in January 2022. We'll have some announcements about the rescheduling of certain dates that were postponed, obviously, as a result of COVID. Looking at September for St. Louis, probably September as well for Houston. Right now, we still have June on the board for Minnesota, and we're probably going to do December Las Vegas. More and more people are getting vaccines. I know my wife's scheduled in a couple weeks. Hopefully I can get one shortly and we can try to get on with our lives. It's going to be a slow and tedious process and getting back to somewhat normal. Talking about normal, that 401k virtual bunch will return on Thursday, March the 10th at 4 p.m. Eastern. Our guest is Dan Venturi. Many people know him from the podcast and, of course, that 401k conferences around the country. So we'll have a chat with Dan and see what he's up to, being a 316 administrator and some of the things that he has to see out there, which, you know, kind of leads to our topic this week, which is how plan sponsors can delegate their fiduciary liability as a 401k plan sponsor. And, you know, that's obviously a big point of 316 plan administration, which we'll talk about. Of course, but again, like I said, go to the events pages at that 401ksite.com for further information. We already have people signing up for that 401k National Virtual Conference. I know it's 11 months away, but before you know it, it's here, and then that's how things are. So, talking about delegation, you know, running business is obviously complicated. You know, you can't, you know, it's hard to be an expert in everything that you do. Even, you know, in my role as a risk attorney with my own practice, you know, there's some situations I have a difficulty in dealing with, and, you know, paying bills and filing taxes and all that kind of stuff. So plan sponsors have that problem. So, you know, it may be wise for these employers that are plan sponsors to cut back on some of their work in dealing with retirement plan administration. You know, it's different in certain situations. You know, a lot of businesses outsourcing, you know, for example, you can outsource your technology. You could have an offsite computer expert. You don't need to have them on staff. You can outsource that. And that's different from delegation. Because there is a difference between outsourcing and delegation. So, you know, the idea is here is we're going to talk to you about the model delegation as it results to retirement plans. And a plan sponsor is always a plan fiduciary, and being a fiduciary, of course, requires the highest standard of care and equity in law. So while a plan sponsor has the responsibility to run their plan, there are, you know, two major problems. The first problem, obviously, is that unless they're in the retirement plan business, they will have to delegate the administration of their plan to third-party providers. You know, like a TPA, like a financial advisor, like an ERISA attorney, like a plan auditor. And of course, the second problem is that by delegating the administration of the plan to a TPA or advisor, the plan sponsor really hasn't delegated their responsibility. You know, hiring a TPA and hiring a financial advisor, plan sponsor is still ultimately on the hook for the work by these plan providers. So the problem is, obviously, is, you know, if the TPA had as much administration background as my 14-year-old daughter, you know, or does, you know, if the advisor is the second coming of Bernie Madoff, the plan sponsor is still ultimately going to be at fault. A plan sponsor can delegate some of their administrative duties in, you know, this delegation arrangement, but they're still on the hook. So, you know, that is obviously a concern. There's always increasing litigation against retirement plan sponsors. We've had some retirement plan providers that have gone bad, shoddy work or, you know, criminal activity or whatnot. So there is the opportunity to kind of outsource responsibility and fiduciary liability by picking, you know, certain providers to provide certain aspects of retirement plan administration. And you could do that, again, by outsourcing the fiduciary functions or components of the plan. The method really isn't, you know, really new. The fiduciaries who offer these type of outsourcing services have a special designation to their service. And, you know, plan sponsors really need to understand the differences between the levels of service and to make sure that they're buying what they think they are buying and that they're getting the level of liability protection that they think they're getting. Because there are enough people in this retirement plan business that will sell you a nickel and tell you that it's a dime. You know, they'll piss on you and they will tell you it's raining. And unfortunately, over the years, I've, you know, dealing with clients, I've run into a lot of these providers. In the true sense of outsourcing, a plan sponsor could eliminate almost all of their liability when it comes to plan administration, plan investments. I always say almost because I still believe that, you know, while you outsource, a plan sponsor outsources, they're still on the hook for hiring that TPA or, you know, 316 administrator or a 338 fiduciary if that fiduciary is completely incompetent. You would still be on the hook for hiring them. You know, and the point with outsourcing fiduciary functions is that, again, like every other thing in the retirement plan business, it's not a right fit for everybody. It just really isn't. Because a lot of plan sponsors really don't need it. It's an added expense. And more importantly, for a lot of people, it's a surrender of control. You know, how many years I would talk to senior citizens, you know, about wills and stuff. When I first started my practice, you know, I would do some wills here and there. And there was always the issue of the Medicare trust to qualify for, you know, Medicare and whatnot. And the whole process basically means that, you know, you have to put everything in a trust and surrender control of your life to, you know, your kids. And believe me, for a lot of senior citizens, they don't want to do that. They don't want to lose that kind of control. And I see that with, you know, any type of service. There are people who want to know everything. I'm one of those type of people. I probably would never hire a 316 administrator if I didn't, you know, an ERISA-covered plan. So it's not for everybody. It's not the right fit for everybody. And you have large employers that are sophisticated employees in terms of, you know, benefit specialists, and they certainly don't need a 316 administrator for their plan or a 338 fiduciary. So, again, not a right fit for everybody, but a good fit for a lot of people. And it's really, you know, the outsourcing can be a la carte. You can outsource the investment control but keep the responsibility of the plan administration house or vice versa or whatnot. Plan sponsor doesn't have to hire a 316 and a 338. They could hire the 338 and keep the administration house or, you know, hire the 316 and use a investment advisor who's serving in a 321 capacity. The first thing, obviously, the ERISA 316 administrator, a TPA you hire is responsible for the plan's compliance, record-keeping, tax filing. There may be, of course, two companies that do that, you know, a separate TPA and separate record keeper. But, you know, those two together, you know, do the same tasks together all in one as when you have a situation where you're only dealing with one TPA. And, of course, a TPA is a third party, which means that, you know, ultimately plan sponsors are responsible for any errors or omissions, you know, and issues dealing with the day-to-day plan administration. If the TPA fails to file Form 5500, it's a plan sponsor who's going to, you know, clean up the mess. If you, you know, a plan sponsor wants to delegate the administration, they're going to hire an ERISA 316 administrator. What's interesting is ERISA 316, what does that mean? It's a cute thing where somebody saw the definition of ERISA for plan administrator on 316 and said, you know what, let me offer a service where I I could take over the responsibility of the day-to-day plan administration. You know, I wonder who was the first one who did that. It's always funny sometimes in the retirement plan business how many people claim that they created the first thing. I know two people personally who have claimed that they invented the everything bagel. I don't know, you know, what that means. It's not like you make money off of it. I remember working for somebody at a TPA shop, and he claimed that he wrote the first Rabbi Trust, and I can never verify that. And I just thought that was like something weird to say that, you know, you were responsible for. I don't know who the first ERISA 316 administrator, but I'm sure that there are several people that claim that they were the first one offering 316 administration in the retirement plan business. You know, success has many parents. Failure is an orphan. So I really don't know who really offered it, but I saw over the years more and more TPAs were offering the service. There are companies out there, including the one that I offer, where I'm an outside 316 administrator with no TPA service. A TPA, again, could be a 316 administrator, or you can hire, like I said, an independent entity to serve in that function. 316 administrator is really a first-party administrator. They have the job of ensuring that all filings with the federal government are timely, making the required and important disclosures to plan participants, hiring the plan service providers no other fiduciary has that responsibility, and fulfilling all the responsibilities as outlined in the plan. The ERISA 316 administrator is a plan fiduciary and assumes the liability that comes with it. However, they have no direction in selecting the plan investments. They can hire and fire the fiduciary, but they don't pick the investments. That's for a 338. For example, a 316 administrator, the problem with 316 administration is contractually there's so many different flavors of it. You know, there's actually 316 administrators that won't sign the Form 5500, which I don't understand. To me, that's the simplest thing a 316 administrator can do. But there are 316 administrators that don't do it. The 316 administrators that don't deal with disclosures. They're just like a check in the balance on the TPA. They sign the 5500 and sign the distribution forms, and that's it. An ERISA 338 fiduciary, that's separate and apart. They're the, you know, ERISA defined investment manager. You go to 338 of ERISA and you'll find it there. Investment manager is somebody who's solely responsible for the selection, monitoring, and replacement plan investment options, as well as all aspects of the fiduciary process, such as developing the investment policy statement and offering participant education. So in this kind of structure, the plan sponsor and other plan fiduciaries are relieved the responsibility for the investment manager's decision. However, the plan sponsor retains a residual duty to prudently select the investment manager and make sure that they're carrying out their appointed duties. Also, the 338 fiduciary has no responsibility dealing with the plan's administration. They may be the Cadillac of investment fiduciaries, but they are kind of the Yugo when it comes to day-to-day running of the plan. That's up to the TPA and or the ERISA 316 administrator. Again, like with 316 administrators, always the plan sponsor needs to always review the contracts and see what's being offered. There are people that claim they are a limited scope ERISA 338 fiduciary. There is no such thing. It really is no such thing. To be a 338 fiduciary, you can't be limited scope. So that's why I always believe that plan sponsors, when hiring a fiduciary, should always check what's being promised and what is not. Dealing with next on the list is the full scope ERISA 321 fiduciary. It's an interesting concept. It's kind of like a hybrid. I don't see that many people offering that anymore. But it's basically a financial advisor who takes on the role of fiduciary as defined in ERISA 321. There are two types, the limited scope 321 or the full scope 321. And the limited scope 321, we see most RIAs doing that. They will not be helping with the outsourcing of the fiduciary responsibility. They will make investment decisions, but ultimately it's the plan sponsor that approves these investment suggestions, and the plan sponsor is still on the hook for liability for the investment component of the plan. The 321 is also administrator, so they are a co-fiduciary. You know, but ultimately the plan sponsor is still on the hook for fiduciary liability. And again, 338 is not for every plan sponsor out there. So there is certainly a reason why somebody would just want to hire a limited scope 321. A full scope can help with outsourcing fiduciary responsibility. A full scope 321 administrator takes on the role of the named fiduciary and has complete discretion, effectively assumes responsibility for the manager and operation of plan. That would include 338. They would be responsible for hiring, monitoring, and replacing all service providers. So, you know, the 321 kind of takes over everything. 321 would hire the TPA. 321 could hire the full scope. 321 could hire the 316. I don't see that. A lot of people call themselves like a 402 named fiduciary as well. The full scope 321 and any type of kind of fiduciary designations outside of 338, 316 need to be reviewed, because you really, plan sponsor really needs to see, again, what is being offered out there in terms of control. And I know that there are certain fiduciaries that have that kind of full scope 321 fiduciary. They don't call it that. They may be a 338 and then still have some fiduciary responsibility dealing with the day-to-day plan administration, day-to-day administration of the retirement plan. So I think it's really important that, again, hiring a fiduciary, before hiring the fiduciary, reviewing the contract and seeing what, you know, everything that is promised and what needs to be done and all that kind of stuff. Last on the list is, of course, the pooled employer plan. That's starting in 2021, of course. We've now in February as we talk. The Internal Revenue Code created a new type of MEP. MEPs, multiple employer plans, where the participant employers were not connected through commonality. They were kind of in a interesting little limbo. So while the Department of Labor created this limbo in 2012, they were very slow to offer any type of solution to get out of this problem with commonality and trying to treat these open MEPs as a single plan. So, of course, it took Congress in 2020 to fix that. And the pooled employer plan eliminates the commonality requirement. But more importantly, it really sets forth down the rules concerning what really is fiduciary liability for the adopting employers and for the what is now the leader of the pooled employer plan, which is the pooled plan provider. You know, the Internal Revenue Code and ERISA was kind of silent as to the fiduciary responsibility for an adopting employer to a multiple employer plan. It was very vague, and we, you know, ERISA attorneys had different opinions about the actual liability of an adopting employer joining a MEP. The pooled employer plans are kind of direct on that issue. There is no fiduciary liability, but there is liability for hire the pooled plan provider. That is that. That's the only fiduciary function that an adopting employer is really responsible for, finding a good pooled plan provider. Of course, you know, as is in this business, a lot of good plan providers, and there's going to be, you know, a couple of bad apples. Speaking of bad apples, the bad apple rule dealing with PEPs doesn't exist as they used to for MEPs. You know, a pooled employer plan is an attractive solution for startup plans or plans where they just really want to eliminate their fiduciary liability. You know, the problem with it, it's like I said, it's not, you know, one of those things that's not a right fit for everybody. It may be a great way to eliminate fiduciary liability, but there may not be cost savings if the pooled employer plan isn't sufficient in terms of plan assets to make it savings. You know, if the PEP isn't big enough, there's going to be zero cost savings. So, you know, that was supposed to be one of the attractions of joining a PEP in the beginning. So, you know, it's here, it's there. We're almost in March, and quite honestly, we still have a lot of plan providers that are very slow in adopting PEPs. Just now I have one PEP that I'm dealing with, and to this day the trustee does not have paperwork outlining the responsibilities of being a trustee on a pooled employer plan. So these are, you know, the issues that we have. So, you know, maybe pooled employer plans will take off. We shall see. But it's one of those another elements of outsourcing fiduciary functions for plan sponsors. I hope you enjoyed this episode. And join me next week for that 401k podcast. And of course, like I said, go to that401ksec.com for further information on how you can sign up for that 401k National Virtual Conference. And of course, sign up for that 401k Virtual Bunch on March 10th at 4 p.m. Eastern. Ari Rosenbaum, signing off. So long.